I hope you've come with the idea of having fun. Now, when I was a very young preacher, I made that statement starting Bible class where I preach. And one of the Bible class teachers I had as a kid, he said, "David, we're not here for fun." Now, he thought fun was like fun and games. And I looked at him, and I still love this brother, even though he's been in eternity for a long time. I said, "Well, Brother Back, I just love studying the Word of God. That to me is fun." Well, this morning we're going to take my two favorite subjects, the Word of God and the Bible, and we're going to look at science. And we're going to take those, and I hope you'll enjoy learning what we have to share with you this morning as we talk about science versus evolution's dating of the earth. So this is part of a series on creation evidences, and what I have seen is these slides transfer a little slower than what I present them, because I'm seeing them ahead of you. And so we're going to be talking about science versus the dating of the earth. And as we do that, we're going to talk about two things. One, does it really matter? There are a lot of people that say it doesn't matter. And that includes preachers in churches of Christ, a lot of academics, even in churches of Christ. Well, it doesn't really matter. Well, let's look at that and let's answer the question from the Bible. Does it matter? And then secondly, what about radiometric dating? Because I can talk about all of the evidence for a young earth, as the Bible seems to teach it, and yet if I don't address radiometric dating, you young people will go to school, and the professors or the teachers will say, "Well, you know, the geologic column or radiometric dating in particular answers all of that." And so we want to address radiometric dating in specific. Now, when you look at Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, God is giving the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel in the wilderness. And he says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath unto Jehovah thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor the strangers within the gates." Now he establishes the command, and then he gives some reasoning behind the command, and he says, "For in 6 days Jehovah made heaven and earth, the sea and all that in them is. And he rested the seventh day, wherefore Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." Now the meaning to that passage is just pretty straightforward. But evolutionists have convinced a majority it took longer than 6 days for the universe to form. So it's almost as if the people who try to accept the Bible and evolution, it's as if these people wanted to say this: "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days thou shalt labor and do all thy work." And you drop down to verse 11, where God's given the command. It says what it really means: for in 6 billion years, or 10 or 20 billion years, Jehovah made the heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the 7 billion years, wherefore Jehovah blessed the Sabbath billion years and hallowed them. It's like advertising your business is open 6 billion years a week. And that's what some very intelligent, educated people would have us to believe. You look at textbooks all the way down on the elementary level, and it talks about vast periods of time, 30 billion years, and you see statements like this, where it says out about 30 million years ago, larger primates such as monkeys and apes evolved. The easiest or the earliest fossil apes that may be ancestral to both humans and modern apes date from 15 to 20 million years ago. When you see statements like this, that says long ago and far away, then you know a fairy tale is coming next. And here's the fairy tale. Here's Grandpa. No, that is a fairy tale. Give you another fairy tale found in our science textbooks taught to children. You're an animal, and you share a common heritage with earthworms. With my scientific background, I have been careful to say that evolutionists don't necessarily believe that we evolved from apes, but from ape-like ancestors. And if you really get down to it, what's the difference? But they say we evolved from earthworms. Well, they say we evolved from a single cell beginning, maybe an amoeba, and then before that, the chemicals. And so, do you have to be that careful? I'm not saying you shouldn't be, but here's what they say that we did. In the evolutionary view of history, is about 10 to 20 billion years ago, everything began. And with a big bang. And we've talked about this last night. The solar system evolved about 5 billion years ago. The Earth, 4.6 billion, all the way down to modern man being here in the last 5 to 10,000 years. And they say that this geologic column represents a historical record of what we just showed you, the history, the theoretical history of the universe, and that the geologic column is the proof, the historical record, like reading a history book. And they link with that the index fossils. They'll show a particular fossil, maybe like the trilobites. It's an index fossil. This occurred 400 million years ago, for an example. And so these index fossils show that this geologic scale, time scale, if you will, is accurate and valid and should be accepted. Now, Professor George Wald, a biochemist who taught biology at Harvard University, Nobel Prize winning professor, he talked about why this is so important. He said, time is in fact the hero of the plot, given so much time, the impossible. Professor Wald, an evolutionist, said evolution's impossible. It becomes possible, the possible probable, the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. You see, they have the idea that time takes care of all of the problems that evolution presents. I showed you last night that the second law of thermodynamics, the law of entropy, is totally opposite of evolution. They know the design of living things does not support evolution, that there's no mechanism in biology to support evolution, and there's no transitional forms, not one, in the fossil record to support evolution. But take all of those problems that evolution has and you sweep them under the rug of time. Because time solves all of that. Time itself performs miracles. That's what they tell us. Time does not minimize the problems of evolution. Even if there's been 15 to 20 billion years, there's not been enough time for evolution to have occurred. I want you to also note, as we're talking about this, they're talking about billions. That's with a B, billions of years old. Then the issue of evolution, if we don't give them the billions, is dead, because in the evolutionist way of thinking, millions is not old. The evolutionist thinks that millions is still young. So if we would agree to millions, no, that's too young, because we've got to have billions. Now, there's a lot of false theories that Christians, and I'm not using that word Christian loosely, I'm talking about Christians used and reinterpret the scriptures, you see, because Christians have accepted the idea of the old earth theory. First one is the gap theory. It claims that vast geologic ages are before the fall of Satan. In other words, this world just took long, long periods of time, and that accounts for all the sedimentary layers that we see. And then Satan fell from grace, and it's kind of like God took him by the nape of the neck, threw him to the earth, and it destroyed the earth. And what you see in the book of Genesis is a recreation on top of all those sedimentary layers. And this is called the gap theory. The idea that you just take all of these ages of time and you wedge them in to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, between there and verse 2. Then there's the progressive creation theory. It claims the days of Genesis 1 are literal days, but they're only days of announcement. You see, on day 1 of Genesis 1 and day 2, God just announced what he was getting ready to do. And then vast periods of time evolved. Now, I'm going to tell you, this progressive creation theory caused a great stir among churches about 25 years ago because some very prominent non-institutional preachers, academics, were preaching this, traveling the country. Some of them were having church services where one of them would teach the adults, and then they would bring in teachers who would teach the children. And back in the children's classrooms, they would pass out the geologic time column and teach the geologic time column and talk about how the earth was millions and yes, even billions of years old. My series did not yet talk about the age of the earth. I was invited to the metro area in Texas, and I was told then, we want you specifically to talk about the age of the earth and address this heresy that's going on. And I told the local preacher I had a lot of respect for. I said, well, I'm not really happy with that lesson, and so I don't really do it yet. And he says, you don't get it. That lesson doesn't come with you. You don't have a meeting. And I saw how important it was because of this stir that was going on. And I said, okay, good. I just threw out that lesson, redid it. And that lesson continues to hopefully change and improve. But they were very happy that I talked about that. You see, the progressive creation theory is this, that there was a Big Bang. Then there was stellar evolution. And then about 4.6 billion years ago, as the earth forms, we started having life. And then life evolved, but it did not evolve without help, because God would speak into existence each stage of life as if it was created. God would create it step at a time over vast periods of time. So I wrote one of the leading people in this and I said, you know, it looks like to me what you're doing is you're teaching stellar evolution and then progressive organic creation. He says, that's exactly what I believe, but if you go about telling people and using my name that I'm a theistic evolutionist, I will resent it. I wasn't even drawing the conclusion for him. He was drawing that conclusion. So it's like you read each one of these days, second day, third day, fourth day, and God is just announcing, here's what I'm getting ready to do, and then it either took billions or millions of years for it to actually happen. This was going all over the country. One of the elders at a church in San Antonio is a good friend of mine. I was preaching in another church. Later I went there. He had me for breakfast. He said, can we talk? He said, we had this guy come to a meeting. We realized early on what was going on. We didn't know what to do. And we talked about that. Well, there's the day age theory, the idea that it took a long period of time, and then Genesis chapter 1, each one of those days is not a day, but it represents these long periods of time. And so you just work those into Genesis 1. And then there's the framework apothesis theory, and there's Christians that adopt this as well. And what they say is when you read Genesis 1 and chapter 2, even with Exodus 20 referring back to it, you're not really reading about how God made the world. It's an allegory. The whole point is that God used that to let you know that he had something to do with how we got here. When I started seeing what was being taught among our brethren, and not to our brethren exclusively, because there's many other churches were doing the same thing. It's one of the problems when you start learning, quote, theology in denominational institutions. It's kind of like this. One of my brethren told me once, he said, it's kind of like being a federal official. And it's your assignment to prosecute pornographers. Can you watch pornography 40 hours a week as a job without it affecting you negatively, even though your goal is good to prosecute the pornographers? He said, no, it has an effect on you. And when you spend all of your upper level studies in graduate school learning theology, it tends to have an effect on a lot of people. Well, there's some that ask, what difference does it make if one believes or teaches these theories? Well, that's really a good question, and I'm glad you ask it, because we're going to answer that question. The first problem all these older theories have in common is they make the days of Genesis 1 and 2 figurative. And so if you make them figurative, really, where is the stopping place? Some say, well, isn't it true that time doesn't mean anything to God? And I always respond to them and say, well, where does the Bible say that time doesn't mean anything to God? And they say, well, doesn't the Bible say somewhere that in Bible time, a day is 1,000 years? Doesn't it say it somewhere? And they want me to provide a scripture for their false thinking. Well, because we're talking about it, I want to show you the scripture they have in mind. It's 2 Peter chapter 3, and beginning of verse 8, where he says, but forget not this one thing, beloved, that one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as a day. They say, see there? God says a day is 1,000 years. No. He says a day as 1,000 years. But you notice how he says it the opposite? 1,000 years as one day? So which way do you want it? If 1,000 years is actually a day, even if Adam lived 930 years or Methuselah 969 years, they didn't make it to the end of the day. You see? Which way do you want it? Give it to them. Say that a day means 1,000 years. So now you look at the 6 days of creation and say, well, it's 6,000 years. That doesn't help the evolutionists to say creation week was 6,000 years long. They need billions of years. If you look at the text, and that's one of the things that false teachers and people that just have false concepts don't usually do. They don't usually read the whole context. And the context is talking about the mind of God. You know, you and I have a pretty good grasp on what's happened this last week. And it's saying it's that way with God. In God's mind, a day goes by, 1,000 years goes by. It doesn't matter. God remembers everything. And so remembering all of this and that the earth is going to be dissolved with a fervent heat, what kind of people should you be? He's bringing everything into judgment, he tells us. Now, the Bible defines the idea of a day. You look at Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. When you get down to verse 5, it says, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. There was evening and there was morning one day. You see, a rotation of the earth, an evening and a morning, is a day. He made the earth on the first day. Heavens, the earth, light, day, and night. One day, a rotation of the earth. Now, what does that mean? Well, look at Exodus chapter 20. As he gives those 10 commandments, he refers back to Genesis 1. He says, for in 6 days, you notice the word is plural? In 6 days, Jehovah made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore, Jehovah blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. He's showing the days of creation, number one, are the very same days the Israelites had in the wilderness. You're in the wilderness, and what you're going to do is you're going to work 6 days. Well, that seventh day comes around, that's a Sabbath day. And he's referring back to creation. He's saying the days you have in the wilderness, the same days that God used in order to create the world. Now, the Hebrew word day is the word yom. almost always used literally, but I want you to know, when it's used with an ordinal number, it's always literal. So an ordinal number is like the word second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth. So you got a second day and a third day. Those are literal days. No exception in the Hebrew Bible. That word found 2,291 times. But here's what's really interesting. The plural days, that word, is the word yamin. Found 845 times and without a single exception, always used in a literal way. So someone says, let's go back to the original languages. I said, I'm glad you want to do that, because we look at that word yamin, days, 6 days, 6 literal days. God made the heaven, the earth, the sea, and all that in them is. So you want to go back to the Greek? You want to go back to the Hebrew? Let's do it. There's a second problem that these old earth theories have in common. What they do is they redefine God. You see, throughout the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, God is described as being the creator. And it refers back to the description of creation we have in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. So God, throughout the Bible, is defined by his creative power. And we recognize in the very first part of the book of Acts, when Peter and John were brought before the Sanhedrin and they were released, they came to the brethren and the brethren praise God and say praises and prayers of thanksgiving. But I want you to notice what they said. When they heard this, they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, Lord, thou art God, in which thou hast made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is. In New Testament times, praying to God meant praying to the God of creation. In Acts chapter 14 and verse 15, when they bowed down before Paul and Barnabas and were trying to praise them as gods, we recognize that these gospel preachers refused that. So in verse 15 of Acts 14, it says, saying, sirs, why do you do these things? We also are men of like passions with you and preach unto you that you should turn from these vanities unto the living God, which made heaven, the earth, the sea, and all things therein. God says, or Paul says, we worship the God of creation. He's referring back to Genesis 1 and 2. In Acts 17, there in Athens, he goes up to Mars Hill. He says, you know, I've been going around and looking in your temples and noticing all the gods that you worship. And I believe there was some 30,000 gods in that city that they worship. And he says, I notice that you worship a God you refer to as the unknown God. And Paul says, he's unknown to you, but that's the God I worship. Let me tell you about him. Verse 24 of Acts 17, God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. He says, the God I worship that you don't know, he's the God of creation. Not the God of the gap theory. Not the God of the day age theory. Not the God of the progressive creation theory. Not the God of the framework hypothesis theory. And you know what? There's more theories than that. Revelation 14, verses 6 through 7 is an interesting verse, because sometimes you have brethren say, well, what difference does it make? Can't we just agree on the plan of salvation and let everything else slide? Because that's the gospel. You need to realize the gospel includes more than just how to initially become a Christian. It involves what we believe. Notice this angel, Revelation 14, 6 through 7. This angel having the everlasting gospel. Fear God and give glory to him and worship him that made heaven, the earth, the sea, and the fountains of the waters. You see, the gospel includes the fact that God is the God of creation. So that's one of the problems all these theories have, is they redefine God. And the third problem these old earth theories have is they contradict Jesus in Mark chapter 10, verse 6, by making man a recent newcomer to the planet. You see, in Mark chapter 10, verse 6, it says, but from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. Now, the old earth theories have this idea that this earth has been here 20 billion years. If man has only been here, as the evolutionists say, in the last 3 million years, that means that man has only been here 0.005% of the time. That's not in the beginning of the creation we all live in, that's at the very end of the creation we live in. They make Jesus Christ out to be a liar. Fourth problem they have is they make Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul, liars. Since Jesus and Paul both refer to creation as a literal historic event. You see, Jesus Christ, the Apostle Paul, taught the events of Genesis were literal historic events. When you look at Mark chapter 13 and verse 19, he says, "For in those days shall be affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation, which God created unto this time, neither shall be." So the second place in the book of Mark, Jesus refers to the creation as a literal event. And you'll also notice in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 13 through 14, the Apostle Paul, by inspiration, says, "For Adam was first formed." We read of that in Genesis 2 last night, didn't we? "Then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in transgression." So you see, the Apostle Paul refers back to Genesis chapter 2 and saying the man was first formed, then the woman. 1 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9, "For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man." Now, pardon me if that goes against woke thinking, but that's what Scripture says. Man was made first, then God took a bone from his side and made the woman. So you see, Jesus and Paul both refer to creation as a literal historic event. John 3:12, Jesus said, "If I told you earthly things and you believe not, how shall we believe if I tell you heavenly things?" In other words, if you can't believe Genesis 1 and 2, if you can't believe all these events in the Bible as being literal, why would you believe me as telling the truth when I'm talking about the plan of salvation? Why would you think I'm telling the truth when I'm talking about heaven itself? It's just a matter if you're going to believe Jesus and if you're going to believe the Bible or not. Now, along with a large number of scientists believe this world is probably only 6,000 to 10,000 years old, and I believe that for a couple of different reasons. Number one, it seems like the Bible indicates this earth is very young. You just can't read Genesis 1 through 11 to get the idea that the earth is billions of years old. But the second thing is the scientific evidence seems to be more consistent with a young earth concept that involves a worldwide flood than it is with a universe that's billions of years old. I've got to tell you, if I didn't believe in God, because I've studied the science about the age of the earth, I would have to still believe that this world is very young. Now, I'd have a dilemma, wouldn't I? If I wouldn't accept God and I believe there's a young earth, I'd say, well, how did it get here? Well, I'd have to say, I don't know, but I'm going to tell you, all the scientific evidence indicates this world is way younger than billions of years old. So with all that said, let's look at the scientific evidence for a younger earth. Evolutionists try to date the earth by two primary methods. And the first is referred to as a relative dating method. You go to the evolutionist, maybe you've got a rock and you've got fossils in it, and you say, well, how old is the rock? Or maybe you say, how old is the fossil? And so here's what happens. In the science labs, in the classrooms, you go to the paleontologist who is the expert when it comes to fossils. And he says this fossil, say, is, for example, 400 million years old. And you say, well, how do you know it's 400 million years old? And he says, well, it's in this rock layer that's 400 million years old. Well, so how do you know that? Well, the geologist tells us the rock layer is that old. Well, that makes sense, kind of, doesn't it? So you go to the geologist and you say, well, how do you know this rock layer is 400 million years old? He says, because the fossil in it is 400 million years old. That's what the paleontologist tells us. And so what you see is they're using each other for their source of authority. And it really amounts to circular reasoning, doesn't it? Tom Kipp said, a circular argument arises. Interpret the fossil record in terms of a particular theory of evolution. Inspect the interpretation and note that it confirms the theory. Well, it would, wouldn't it? David Kitts, the University of Oklahoma, said the record of evolution, like any other historical record, must be construed within a complex of particular and general preconceptions, not the least of which is the hypothesis that evolution already occurred. You have to believe in evolution, make some assumptions, and then you use each other as your source of authority. It is circular reasoning. Niles Eldridge, one of the most famous evolutionists in the world. You go to Barnes & Noble, you can see his books. His books on paleontology are popular books nowadays. And Niles Eldridge wrote, and this poses something of a problem, if we date the rocks by the fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about patterns of evolutionary change in the fossil record? That's what he's saying. It's not me, a creationist, saying that it's circular reasoning. The evolutionists agree that it's circular reasoning. Now, the second thing the evolutionists do to try to show long periods of time is they use what's called an absolute method of dating. It doesn't mean absolute in the fact they can give you a date like April 26 in a particular year. But they're saying this is less subjective than the one we just talked about. And here's what they do. They say there are a lot of elements that are radioactive, and they decay until they become a stable element. For an example, up on the screen, you see uranium-238. It is a radioactive element, and it gives off daughter elements until it ultimately becomes lead-206. So you've got uranium-238, it gives off an atomic weight, an alpha particle of 4 becomes thorium-234. Essentially, that's a helium. Becomes protactinium-234, which becomes uranium-234 that gives off another alpha particle. Becomes thorium-230, gives off an alpha particle, becomes the next, and the next all the way down to lead. And so you need to understand that, in a sense, uranium is the parent element, and all these other stages are the daughters. Now, I'm going to tell you, that is a fact. This happens. And our issue is not whether you can measure how long it takes for that to happen, because we can very accurately determine how long it takes for uranium-238 to become lead-206. But concerning radiometric dating, you need to know that radiometric dating is not used in the sedimentary rocks like limestone and sandstone, but it's used for igneous rocks, which are once molten or liquid rock. So, when you look at the geologic column, typically you're looking at sedimentary rocks. And if you go to school and you're presented the geologic column and you raise your hand and say, well, how do you know each one of these layers is so old? And if the answer is we know this because of radiometric dating, then you know to just think in your mind, bless your heart, you don't understand how this works. A few years ago, I was in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We had the afternoon off, and the local preacher took me up to Mammoth Caves. We're down under this layer of sandstone. And the guy that's a tour guide, he's telling us about how vastly old this is, millions of years old above us. And the preacher kind of elbowed me. And I raised my hand, and I said, just curious, how do you know? He says, well, radiometric dating answers that. I said, you do know that radiometric dating is not used for sediment, and sand or limestone is a sediment, right? At that point in time, this guy went ballistic on me. got mad, yelled and screamed in front of the whole group. I mean, we had a pretty good tour group going. Well, I'm not looking for a fight. I didn't say anything else. I just listened to him yell and scream, and then we went on and finished our tour. To his credit, as we got out in the parking lot, here he came. I turned to this preacher, and I'm going, oh, no, I hope he's not coming for a fight. And he wasn't. He came to apologize. And he said, you know, you evidently, you know a lot more about this than I do. He says, I'm not an expert in this. I only have a master's degree in geology. And I looked at him, I said, well, here's what you need to understand. If you still have a library of your textbooks in geology, go to the one that's a freshman geology book. And the freshman geology books will all tell you that sedimentary layers are not dated by radiometric dating. You have to have rock that was igneous rock. In other words, molten like lava, and it supposedly sets the time back to zero. And that's not sedimentary rock. I just got to share this with you. A few years later, took my older son, Reagan. We were there for a debate in Bowling Green, and we had the day off before the debate that night. We went, and the tour guide kept looking at me. We were on a bus. You go on a bus, and I whispered to Reagan, I said, that's the guy. After these years, he remembers me. Anyway, we went on the tour, and I think he'd kind of toned it down because he saw me there. But the issue about radiometric dating is not our ability to measure the rate of decay. It's with the assumptions that are made, because when you're doing this aging system, you make a lot of assumptions. I want to share with you what these assumptions are. Here's how you first of all date a system. You look first of all at the system. You got to observe it. That's what you do in science. You look at things. And then you measure a process rate within the system. And then you make certain assumptions about the past. And then you calculate the time necessary for that process to form the present state. So here are the assumptions. You assume a constant rate of decay. You assume a closed system, that there's been no gain or loss of a parent or daughter element, and you also assume that you had knowledge of how it was at the very beginning. So what I want to do is I want to give you an illustration. It rains a lot in Houston. We've already been rained on more than once since we've been down here. And so you're familiar with how rain works, and maybe it's been raining, and you've been on a trip maybe for a week, and you come home, it's still raining, or maybe it is raining. When you left, it wasn't. And you go, I wonder how long this rain's been going on. So you go out there to your rain gauge and you look at it. And why do you do that? Because you want to observe the present state. And this is the question that scientists do when they're looking at rocks. How long has this been deteriorating? So again, the first step in the process is you observe the present rate of the system. And you look at that rain gauge and you notice that it's 2 inches. And then you measure the process rate. So you sit back and you start looking, how much is it raining right now? You weren't there when it filled the first 2 inches, but you look at it and you go, okay, 1 hour, got an inch. So the rate is 1 hour per inch is what you're observing. So you go from step 1, 2, then you go to step 4 and you calculate the time necessary for that process to produce the present condition. So the condition is, when you first looked at it, 2 inches. Now you measure the process rate while you're there, and it's 1 hour per inch. So you do the mathematics, say, well, it must have been raining for 2 hours before we got home and could look at the rain gauge. Now the question is that the correct age of the system? Did you notice that I skipped step number 3? I didn't talk about the assumptions that are being made. And so the assumptions that are made is, number 1, that you have a constant decay rate. Now, when y'all see rain here, does it always just come down at a particular rate? You know, if you're Oregonians, and I've got to tell Oregonians about this, I've lived in Oregon. It rains every day for 9 months. Stopping most of the time in the summer, and you only get 40 inches of rain in the Portland, Oregon area when I lived there. And though it's a very constant just a mist. Nobody that's a true Oregonian even carries an umbrella or has a raincoat. Doesn't rain fast enough to need it. You see someone with an umbrella, he's not an Oregonian. Well, we know different. We know that he may have one of these frog strangler rainstorms. I've driven down here in Houston when it's like that, and your car, if you go too fast, it starts coming up off the ground, right? And then it'll slow down to almost not raining at all, and then it's a little bit faster, and then bam, it's all again. So you have to assume there's been a constant amount of rain, because you see, it may have been slower than this observed session. It may have been faster. It may have been the exact same amount. The second assumption you got to make is that it's a closed system, that nobody's been adding. No one's taken a water hose and filled your rain gauge. You see, if they did that, it would be different. Then there's the second thing. You got to assume it's a closed system. Nobody's come up and emptied your rain gauge during that period of time. Let any out. Then there's the third assumption, that you know exactly how it started, because if you're gone for a week, it might have rained, stopped for several days, and now it started again. You don't know how this rain gauge started out. You know when you left on vacation, you emptied it, but you don't know what happened while you were gone. And so you have to make these assumptions. And so just to summarize, first of all, you have to assume a constant rate of decay. Now, there's a lot of processes in the universe that we have used in mathematical formulas in physics as a K or a constant and are now being questioned. That's really interesting. And have been questioned for some time, that we think this has always been constant, but we don't really know about the past. We got to assume this closed system and no gain or no loss of the elements, and we have to assume that we know the initial conditions at the start. And I think it's not necessarily wrong for a scientist to speculate about these things, but don't you think they ought to do it with a little more humility, because they don't really know? And they present these speculations as almost gospel truth. This fourth assumption is the real Achilles heel of radioisotope dating, because if daughter elements are present at the start, it really messes with the whole system. So in practice, how does radiometric dating actually work? Well, the best way to do this is to calibrate the system with rocks that you know how old they are. And when you know how old they are, then you can see, well, is this working? Does that make sense? It's kind of like, I used to be a weighmaster for a wrestling program. We had to always recalibrate the scales to make sure, they were spot on. If it said that a boy weighed 50 pounds, it was exactly 50 pounds, not less, not more. And you take weights of a known amount, you put them on the scale, and you make sure that scale is calibrated. So I think we can calibrate this system by looking at rocks that we already know how old they are. For an example, you go to Sunset Crater in northern Arizona, and there's Indian artifacts in the lava flows. The Indians tell the story that this happened about 900 years ago. Tree ring dating from the trees that are in the lava date back to about 1065 AD, about 900 years ago. But then you take potassium argon dating, a form of radiometric dating, you date the lava, and the lava indicates from that method it's 210 or 230,000 years old. Now, what is it? There's somewhat of a historical account and other ways of dating to say maybe 900 years, but radiometric dating says no, as much as 230,000 years. Then we go to Mount Rangitoto, New Zealand. Potassium argon dates the lava at 485,000 years old, almost a 500,000 years old. Yet radiocarbon dates the trees in the lava flow as only being 300 years old. So you take two different methods of radiometric dating and they conflict between 300 years and a 500,000 years. Which one do you believe? Looks like radiometric dating doesn't always work, especially when you know how old the rocks are. Well, you go to Hawaii. There's an eruption that was witnessed between 1800 and 1801. The lava is supposed to be too young to produce radiogenic argon or helium, but both gases are found in large quantities. So different dating methods are used. 12 different dates were determined for the same lava, and they range between 140 million years to almost 3 billion. You average them, and the average is 1.4 billion years old for the lava, yet this was witnessed, history says, 200 years, just a little over. Can you trust radiometric dating on rocks you already know how old they are? You go to Mount Kilauea in Hawaii, where there's been an active volcano, and you use radiometric dating to date the lava in different depths as it pours out into the sea. You go down to 1,400 meters, and you see that it's supposed to be brand new, 0 years of age. But deeper than that, at 3,400 meters, 12 million years old, and 4,600 meters, 21 million years old. It's the same lava, it's just different depths, and how the depth and the water pressure is affecting what's being produced. Radiocarbon dating is not necessarily reliable. There's still the assumptions and a fix-it-as-it-go approach. Contamination here, fractionation there, calibration whenever possible. It should be no surprise then fully half of the dates are rejected. The wonder is surely the remaining half come to be accepted. No matter how useful it is, though, radiocarbon dating is still not capable of yielding accurate and reliable results. The accepted dates are actually selected dates. And I've talked to scientists and heard scientists lecture about how this very thing happened. You ever watch The Fugitive? You know, that movie about what was taking place and there was a cover-up to try to cover up what was going on, you know, in the scientific labs and research to medicine. Let me tell you what, there's more truth to the story behind that story than what you know. I've been involved in scientific research, and I'm aware of other scientific research, and scientists are not always academically honest when it comes even to your medication. Well, it looks like this is the conclusion we can come to. When you know the rock's age already, radiometric dating doesn't seem to work. But when you don't know, let's use it and assume it works. I got a problem with that, and let me ask you, does it make you want to raise your hand and ask a question? Here's my question. Are there any other ways to date the Earth? Oh, yes, there are. And let's think about some of these. For an example, population statistics. You know, in spite of all sorts of famines, plagues, wars, mass weaponry, brutal genocide, the population growth rate in this world has been pretty steady. At about 2% per year, an increase in population growth. Start with an original couple. We could call them Adam and Eve, but better yet, let's call them Mr. and Mrs. Noah. Do you realize that the present population rate of just 2%, you start with this original couple, and it only takes about 1,100 years to get the present population of 7 billion? And yet the flood occurred about 4,300 years ago. Just takes 1,100 years of the present population growth rate to get the population we have on Earth. So modern man's been around for only 1 million, and that's helping the evolutionists, because we could say 3 million, like many of them say. Evolutionists teach 1 to 3 to 8 million years. With a present population growth rate of 2%, start with a couple, do you realize that 1 million years later, you'd have a population of 1 × 10^8,600th power? Where would you put all those people? Would there be room on the planet for that many people? Well, let's look at that same question a little bit differently. If modern man's been around for only 1 million years, the population growth rate to produce today's population, 7 billion from an original couple, would only be 0.002% of the time. What would that mean? What that would mean is it takes 35 to 36,000 years to go from Mr. and Mrs. Noah to four of them. and another 35,000 years to go to 8. Does that seem logical? Just use your pencil and do simple math, and you'll see that we have a lot of problems with this ancient earth, and population statistics is one of them. Population statistics, is that all reasonable, or does it indicate more of a young earth? Yeah, young earth. Look at the decay of the earth's magnetic field. The earth's magnetic field is so very important to us. We have this sphere of magnetism that deflects so much cosmic radiation that's harmful to us. And we have to have this magnetic field in order for life as we know it to survive. And yet, it's diminishing. Precise measures have been made on this magnetic field since 1829. Its half-life is about 1,400 years. So every 1,400 years, this magnetic field is only 50% as strong as it was 1,400 years earlier. Now, if you think about that and you start going back in time, you go back just 20,000 BC. This magnetic field would be so strong at 20,000 BC, it would totally disrupt the integrity of our planet. Go back 100,000 years, and the heat generated by the magnetic field of planet Earth would be comparable to a neutron star. Now, a neutron star is a star that's about 10 miles in diameter and produces tremendous amount of heat. The scientists tell us, well, you know, that magnetic field must have been changing. He said, do you have any scientific data that shows that? Well, none, but we have this conclusion. We know the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, and this magnetic field would not allow it to be that old, so it has to be reversing ever so often. It's just speculation, not the result of science. And so the Earth's magnetic field indicates that we have got a pretty young Earth. There's other ways of looking at this. The age of the atmosphere. Let's just say that we start off with no helium, none. I showed you by radioactive decay that these alpha particles are being put off, and essentially that's helium. Start off the Earth with no helium at all, and only get the helium that's produced by this radioactive decay. Do you know it only takes 2 million years to have the amount of helium in the atmosphere we have today? And 2 million years is young, because we're not into billions. Yet I believe at creation, God no doubt created helium. But the accumulation of ocean sediments. You know, at the present rates, all the sediment in the ocean would accumulate in no more than 14 million years. The blanket of sediment on the ocean floor averages about 1,200 feet thick. And yet, if the oceans were a billion years old, the sediment would be 100,000 feet thick. Someone says, well, how did we get so much sediment if by natural processes it would take 14 million years? Still young from the evolutionist point of view, but when you start reading the book of Genesis, you read about the worldwide flood, and wow, that accounts for a lot of sediment. A couple of years ago, I took my oldest grandson, Parker, on a trip to the Grand Canyon. We helicoptered down into the bottom of the canyon. We got on J-rig boats. We spent 3 days going down the canyon. We were traveling with the Institute for Creation Research scientist, Dr. Tim Clary, PhD in geology, well known throughout the world. He was showing us these sediments and how they're most likely formed in the Grand Canyon by the worldwide flood. Still on top of the canyon, you look down, it goes down a mile, sedimentary layers, all on top of the great nonconformity. The nonconformity is the rock below all this sediment, and you can see it in certain areas of the Grand Canyon, in which is not sediment, and we believe, both evolutionists and non-evolutionists, that that is the original rock. And on top of that original rock, the great nonconformity, then you have all these sedimentary layers. When you have a worldwide flood, it produces tremendous amounts of sediment in the ocean and on top of the earth. When you look at the accumulation of ocean sediments, what you see is evidence, huge evidence for a young earth. And then you look at the erosion of the continents. At present rates, the continents would all be eroded in no more than 14 million years. And then you think about the salt water in the ocean. Let's just pretend at the start it wasn't salt water. Let's pretend it was distilled water with no salt in it at all. Do you realize that the processes of salt being added to the ocean now could accumulate for all the salt in the saltwater oceans in only 62 million years? Not billions, millions. So the salt in the ocean is another way of showing that this earth is so incredibly young. The science over and over again shows a young earth. And then a tremendous evidence for a young universe is that galaxies wind themselves up too fast to be billions of years old. The stars in the Milky Way galaxy rotate about the galactic center at different speeds. The inner area of our spiral galaxy rotates much more quickly than the outer area. In just a few hundred million years, it would not be a spiral galaxy. It would be a featureless disk. And yet we have a spiral galaxy. Evolutionists have known about this for over 50 years, and they call it the winding up dilemma. They have no scientific way to explain this because they make the assumption of a very old, old universe. You see, you just look at one thing after another from science, and it agrees with the Bible. Unless you give them a whole lot of assumptions, starting with the assumption that the universe is 10 to 20 billion years old. So what I would suggest is time is running out on the theory of evolution. This world is not as old as the universe as the scientists indicate that are evolutionists. It's more like what the Bible says. And in John 8:32, we know the truth, that the truth should make you free. Thank you for your very kind attention. I've got straight up 11 o'clock. I think we're supposed to start in about 10 minutes on the second and final lecture of the morning. And so if you'll take a quick break, if you need to, that'd be great. And we'll meet back here in about 10 minutes.